It's been 12 years since you last visited Murray State University. In that space of time, you've done enormous works, including this book that earned you the 2005 Lannan Literary Fellowship, When Winter Come, the Ascension of York. Did I read correctly? This fellowship is a $75,000 award?
That's correct, but it's all gone now.
Well, it's been a while. Well, congratulations on that, and what seems to be a life of enormous energy in both literary achievement and in public works, both as an educator and as a living, breathing poet who goes around a lot.
I am pretty busy. I think I don't know any other speed, I guess, is probably the best answer.
Well, I'm impressed at the breadth of the places you visit yearly, from libraries to prisons to high schools to colleges. I mean, it's a tremendous breadth of outreach for your poetry.
I think poetry is meant to be a public art. I don't write it for myself. You know, I think that I'm either trying to tell a story or share a narrative, and I'm looking for willing audiences. And I believe that poetry belongs to everyone, so I'm always excited to go to the places that don't expect to get poets or anybody because they don't have a budget or people think about them in a certain way. So I do a lot of prison visits in Alabama and Kentucky, every kind of school. You know, this past year I actually had a chance to visit a medical facility where it's almost like a jailed program for these kids. They treated me like a rock star. I mean, I really enjoyed being there, but I know it had more to do with the fact that people have forgotten them and they're kind of locked away and tucked away. And some of the most eager audiences to talk about writing are people in prison because they have all that time to read and process the information. And they're looking for, you know, a willing conversationalist, and they almost never get the author in those spaces. So I do it as much for me and my own ego as for them, and to let them feel like part of the literary community.
I would think you must sense a great deal of love.
Well, I don't know that it's love. I think it's appreciation for the word. I think something happens to people who are connected to literature and stories, and although they never articulate it in this way, I think young men in prison experience a kind of intellectual awakening once they become literate at the level to just want to consume books over and over again, having lived a life disrespecting anything that was in a book, you know, having failed school and life and ended up in prison. You know, I think that the world had to be much smaller if your imagination was limited. But I think the thing that books give you is this unlimited capacity to project yourself anywhere in the universe or at the bottom of the ocean or a different time period. I don't think that's available to people who don't read, who don't know those stories, who don't know the history and the potential of all things that exist in the world, imaginary or otherwise.
I was wondering if you know of any high schools who teach your books about York along with the Lewis and Clark strict histories.
There are quite a few out west, in the northwest, the other side of the Mississippi River, where Lewis and Clark is a much bigger deal than it is here in the States. I know that there was a little bit of hubbub during the bicentennial celebration in Kentucky, and then it disappeared. But, you know, once you get to Montana, the entire state park system is based on the Lewis and Clark Trail. There are highways that are Lewis and Clark highways. My son and I took the Lewis and Clark Express Amtrak train from Spokane to Chicago. So that history is still very present there. So anything Lewis and Clark is important. I probably do more readings and visits to schools and colleges and conferences in the Northwest and anywhere else because of those two books and because of the appreciation for Lewis and Clark. I would say in Kentucky, maybe a handful of schools, including my own Danville High School and Ball County High School, quite a few community colleges in the state, several universities like Thomas More in Northern Kentucky and Northern Kentucky University, and it's used in several classes at the University of Kentucky even, but it's amazing how I think accessible and broad it is to all those audiences. It doesn't lock anybody out and just opens the door for larger conversations.
Indeed. Just what you said about the opening up of an imaginative look at something real that happened long ago and putting your own voice into the black man York who went with Lewis and Clark on that exploration, and into the people around him as well. It's really a fascinating book, and I wondered if you'd like to start with that. I'd also like, of course, to hear more about your book about the celebrated black jockey Isaac Murphy, but may we begin with some of the voices from the book dealing with York's experiences?
Absolutely. Let me see. I have a few of these marked per your request. And the first one I'd like to share is a poem called In the Name of the Father. It's in the voice of York, and it tries to picture him trying to reconcile the religious differences that he witnesses, or I imagine him witnessing, visiting the numerous tribes out west and thinking about what he knows from his own African-American experience and from watching his masters and how they worship, but putting them all in the same space. In the name of the Father. Them call the old guide that led us through the mountains, Toby. Sacagawea, Janie. Peleliu Jean Baptiste, Pomp. And me boy, and worse if it crossed their minds. Them call the beautiful Namipu, Nez Perce, though we never seen a pierced nose in the mountains or plains. Them give a name to every stream and place we come across. Even named a group of small islands after me, without ever thinking to ask the people who lived there if they already had names. What is it, I wonder, gets in a white man's head so that when him look in the mirror, him always see God? But when him look at people with hair like lamb's wool or feet of burnt brass, him only see devils or children.
Good question.
A poem, to me, does its best work if it leaves the reader with a question. And that question, if it doesn't start a dialogue, it sends you in search of an answer. It makes you think about something in a different way that you may not have considered before. And that's one of my favorite things about poetry, just what it allows you to do on your own or in the group.
I noticed that Your writing a complete sentence sometimes doesn't depend on there being a period, and in other times it does.
Yes, I think one of the challenges of writing in dialect is trying to capture an authentic syntax or a way of speaking that feels authentic to the person or the character that is created. You can help create character by how the person talks. And all those things, of course, are based on what they may experience, where they live, who they communicate with on a regular basis, how much education they do or don't have. But it was really important to me to make sure all the speakers sounded a little different from each other, and that the way the poems looked on the page also looked a little different from each other. To help extend this idea of character. I think after a while, after living with these poems for so long, all these characters are real to me, and I'm sure in my dreams they walk around and talk and interact so often that I recognize them even just hearing them speak. So I try to do things on the page that allows people to try to arrive at the same pacing that I've kind of set down on the page to help create the character. Then after that, it's between the reader and their imagination.
Please share another.
Sure. I will read, this is a longer one, and it actually tries to recognize all the major waterways they traveled through to get to the ocean and back, and the other things that contain water and the power of water at the same time. And it's in the voice of the river itself. And it's called The River Speaks. And has an epigraph that is a Langston Hughes quote that says, "My soul has grown deep like the rivers. The river speaks. Call me the Ohio, the Mississippi, or the Missouri. Call me wood, Teton, Yellowstone, Milk, Judith, Marias, Jefferson, Madison, Beaverhead, Bitterroot, Snake, Clearwater, or Palouse. Call me the wide-toothed mouth of the Columbia River. Call me after my many creeks, my great falls, my hot springs. I am the snow atop Mount Adams. I am the salty hope in the air at Cape Disappointment. I am she who is the deep and the shallows, a thundering waterfall in a quiet storm. I am always present in the air, on every tongue, in every drop of milk and blood and tear. You will find me in every thorn and flower, seed and fruit. There is no life without me. I am libation and baptismal pool. I am your sprinkle of holy water. I am older than man and light. I am of God, not God, but like God. I am also inside of every man, for all are born in me and formed there until they are flushed naked into the world. And I remain there in them like God until they depart and return to dust. Captain Clark saw me as a great wet road that could be conquered with the rowing and paddling of men under his command. So I showed him my many rapids and waterfalls, made his men carry their own boats and supplies around me for miles at a time. These were the good years. White men had not yet studied the beaver and learned how to redirect my paths, manage my flow, harness it for their own use, attempt to enslave me too. Captain Lewis was different. To him, I was a piece of art. He marveled at the natural falling of my water locks and felt humbled by the beautifully carved rock masterpieces that adorn my canyons and walls. While I have been at most an open way for the white man, to the red man, I have been viewed as a helpmate, considered a wife, carrying their salmon and trout, providing for their transportation and nourishment, surrounding them, moving through them in the heat of the sweat lodge, answering their prayers when they dance. But the black one was the only one taught to both fear and respect me. And though I was the road that carried the ships of death to and from Africa's shores, I became the waiting, outstretched arms for those who refused to be enslaved, for those who trusted me to rock their babies off to sleep. My ocean floors are covered with his people's resistance. I carry their spirit in every splash I make. Their humming, their lost voices, their last words have become a part of my sweetest songs. When he is whole again, when York knows what he is worth, I will well up inside of him, and he will hear them sing. That's a long while.
And it's laid out on the page in a sort of a meander. It moves so from the actual and physical to the metaphysical. Must have felt good to write that?
It felt good to get to the end. You know, it took a lot of tries to get there because I was trying to do something bigger for that particular one. You know, in this collection, most of the poems are one or two pages, and this is, you know, twice as long as that. But I also knew that I needed to be a concrete poem, that it needed to look like or evoke the shape of a river, of that back and forth and the meandering you referenced, and wind its way, you know, to an end, but somehow find a way to connect itself to everything that contained liquid or water, you know, metaphysically and physically. And it was the first poem that was suggested to be made into a broadside. So there are copies of the opening poem in Buffalo Dance, and from this collection, The River Speaks, is that one poem that represents the entire book as the one that really looks good on paper. I think can stand on its own and not need the entire book to put it in context.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind skipping to the Goodbye to the Ocean?
Okay. How to Say Goodbye to the Ocean. This is one of the poems in the voice of Sacagawea, the young 15-year-old mother who left on the expedition with a 3-month-old but completed it. I'll just read it. How to Say Goodbye to the Ocean, Sacagawea. When I meet the great water, she who the raven call Yemaya, I close my eyes and feel her fingers pull me out toward her circle, away from men, birthing a joy warmer than any I've ever known. But when I can no longer smell her salt in the air and her song gets too soft to hear, my own water breaks again, but this time, instead of a brave little hunter or dancer, I give birth to a great emptiness I know I'll carry on my back forever.
How did you get there?
Well, you know, I think for me, I thought about how I always felt at the ocean. You know, standing on the edge of the beach, it always seemed to be this not-so-subtle pull, almost like a magnetic thing that just kind of pulls you into the water. And then my friends who grew up in South Carolina and on in and near other beaches when they moved to Kentucky, they always talked about how much they missed the ocean and how landlocked this place was and how it hurt, that it was like a divorce or a close relative that was not in their life. And so I was just trying to connect with that, the natural, I think it's a natural emotional connection that human beings make with this large body of water. That somehow there's obviously a kinship there, you know, consider all the water in each of us, how we're mostly water, and that once we meet that larger body of water, we recognize our kinship. And I think that's what sets off the magnetic force that we feel as it pulls us out. And then there's also the, you know, the actual pulling that happens when you stand in the water and the waves try to pull you out into the deep. But when I thought about Sacagawea as a young mother, and I know how sensitive young mothers are, you know, I have 7 sisters, and the most I've ever seen any of them cry have always been around the time when their nerves were all at the very edge because they had just given birth, and they seem to be ultra-sensitive. Something about the process of childbirth that made them even more human, or maybe more in touch with everything in the world. So I was just simply trying to connect or find the connections in that space and hopefully, you know, leave enough clues that other people might recognize it too.
I suppose I need to break the spell of When Winter Come and move to more recent work. I suspect you'll be reading from when you're in Murray, Thursday, November 1st, for the Creative Writing Reading Series. Will you be reading from the book about Isaac Murphy?
I probably will read a few poems from there, but I'm also going to read from a new collection that comes out in the spring of next year about Megar Evers, that I'm really close to because I feel like I just finished it, but we're at the final layouts and design stages, so it's really fresh in my heart right now.
Would you share a few from that work?
Sure. The challenge of this work in the Meg Evers series is that I wanted to tell a story. Well, I wanted to write another collection of historical poems first, but I wanted to do it in a way that it was a little more challenging. So I made a decision to try to tell a story and leave Megger out of it, you know, minus, you know, his contribution to the title. I mean, the actual title comes from his final words. You know, he said on his deathbed in the hospital, he actually said the words, "Turn me loose," and then died shortly afterwards. Other than that, this collection is primarily in the voice of the assassin, Byron Daly Beckwith, which stretched me quite a bit because it was easier for me to imagine the voice of York, who was just another black man who lived in a different time period. But it was harder for me to imagine what it was like to think and be this virulent racist, Byron Daly Beckwith, who bragged about having committed the assassination and hated everything that I represent. So that was, it was a difficult place to get to conduct the research. But once I got into trying to build the collection, I mean, it became a very worthy challenge, because one of the things I had a chance to do was to create what I think is a manuscript or a book that really easily becomes a blueprint for racial reconciliation. That if you can actually work your way through or survive the painful poems at the beginning, then you really appreciate what happens at the end of the book when his widow, Merle Evers, actually forgives the killer. It's, you know, it takes a while to get there. And the killer's two wives and Merle Evers, the widow, they help transition and get you to that higher place, if you will. Well, I'll read the two poems I think fit well together. There's a poem called Sorority Meeting, which tries to imagine what the widow would have said to the wives of the killer. So it's Merle Evers in an imagined conversation to Thelma and Willie Daly Beckwith. And then that poem is followed by, I think, my favorite poem in the collection, which is in the voice of the bullet. And the details of the bullet poem are actually taken from the court transcripts I use as part of my research. So I'm going to read Sorority Meeting, followed by one-third of 180 grams of lead, back-to-back. Sorority Meeting. Merle Evers speaks to Willie and Thelma Daly Beckwith. My faith urges me to love you. My stomach begs me to not. All I know is that day made us sisters somehow. After long, nervous nights and trials on end, we are bound together in this unholy sorority of misery. I think about you every time I run my hands across the echoes and the hollows of my sheets. They seem loudest just before I wake. I open my eyes every morning, half expecting Medgar to be there. Then I think about you, and your eyes always snatch me back. Your eyes won't let me forget. We are sorority sisters now, with a gut-wrenching country ballad for a sweetheart song, tired funeral and courtroom clothes for colors, and secrets we would take to our graves. I was forced to sleep night after night after night with a ghost. You chose to sleep with a killer. We all pledged our love, crossed our hearts, and swallowed oaths before being initiated with a bullet. And then one-third of 180 grams of lead. Both of them were history, even before one pulled the trigger. Before I rocketed through the smoking barrel hidden in the honeysuckle, before I tore through a man's back, shattered his family, a window, and tore through an inner wall, before I bounced off a refrigerator and a coffee pot, before I landed at my destined point in history, next to a watermelon. What was cruel was the irony, not the melon, not the man falling in slow motion, but the man squinting through the crosshairs, reducing the justice system to a small circle, praying that he not miss, then sending me to deliver a message, as if the woman screaming in the dark or the children crying at her feet could ever believe a bullet was small enough to hate. So those are from the darker passages in the collection.
The specificity of the trajectory is really stunning.
I think that's a byproduct of really good research. And when I was flipping through the court transcripts and I came across that information, I knew immediately that there was something there that was useful, because I was taken by the same detail. And to capture it in a poem was a real treat for me. As I said earlier, it's probably my favorite poem in the whole collection.
In the preceding poem, there's such generosity of a very strange sort.
The challenge in that the book, and also one of the things that acts as glue, you have these two men who are, well, one declares the other the enemy, and the other may not feel the same way, but, you know, what does that mean for the women who are attached to those men? Is the wife of the killer also a monster? What's the widow's defined role now that her husband is gone? You know, who's guilty? You know, what does she lay to blame? Can she get past all that? And I think exploring the interior of the women's lives really allow us to approach the story in a very humane way, and it allows us to deconstruct, hopefully, what I think does a fair job explaining where violence born of racism comes from, and what it's trying to do when it acts out, and what it's acting out of. And, you know, I really believe that, you know, that kind of examination up close is really what reconciliation is about, is the kind of resurfacing that pain and dealing with it, and with, you know, both the victim and the perpetrator in the same space. But I really do believe a kind of healing happens after the examination, even if it doesn't approach forgiveness, that the knowledge, the additional understanding that might come out of the conversation is worth the conversation alone. I think this is a very ambitious collection. You know, I hope that it can do some of the things that I hope it can do. You know, I'm fortunate enough to have made connections with the Evers family. You know, it's being released on the 50th anniversary of four significant things. And, you know, in 1963, we had the March on Washington. We had the bombing of the Full of the Girls in the church in Birmingham. We had the assassination of JFK, and we had the assassination of Mega Evers, all in that one year.
Mm-hmm.
So when the book comes out next year, you know, I imagine people will be talking about these things, and I'm hoping that the book will be a conversation piece, and people can figure out the blueprint that exists there, that's been laid there, to have that additional conversation, because I still believe that in spite of having a black president, that this is not a post-racial America, that race is still the elephant in the room, the very difficult thing to talk about. But as much as people don't want to admit it, is very, very present in this election and not so often in the background. You know, I think people would love to explain away some things as classism and not racism. But I believe everybody is prejudiced. Everybody has their issues that they may have been socialized with growing up. But until they confront them or acknowledge them, we can't get past them. And not talking about it is worse than pretending like they don't exist. If it doesn't work, hopefully people say, well, it's a good collection of poems. It didn't do the work that he thought it could do. But when I'm feeling really optimistic, I think, and I hope people will get it.
I think they'll get it. Mr. Walker, thank you. I appreciate your spending so much time with me.
Well, you're welcome. You know, whatever you can do to get people to come out, the more the merrier. You know, it's a oral tradition. It's best served aloud to people with ears. So, you know, tell your colleagues and friends and poetry lovers and people who just like history, that if they'll come up, I'll do my best to give them a good reading, and we'll see what happens.